You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Mazzio. I represent the appellant Cameron Bowman this morning. I ask to reserve 3 minutes of my time this morning for rebuttal. My argument this morning requires a close look at the Virginia Criminal Code Statute 18.2-200.1, commonly referred to as the construction fraud statute, and specifically going to reference what I am going to term the demand letter requirement. Toward the end of that particular statute, there is a requirement laid out that requires, in order for the Commonwealth to meet their burden on the construction fraud charge, them to prove that a request was made in writing to the defendant and that an advance be returned within 15 days of the receipt of the letter, and that that request be made by certified mail, that it be done with a return receipt requested, and that it be sent to the last known address of the defendant or the address that was listed in the contract. This court in the Jimenez case has referred to this part of the statute as the notice requirement. I think that perhaps that's a bit of a misnomer in the term itself, because it suggests that the issue is about whether or not the person receives notice. But of course, the Jimenez case goes on to say that although the notice requirement is a material element and it must be complied with, that it's not actually about whether or not the person received notice, because specifically the Jimenez court said that the actual notice, which was in that case verbal, being provided to the defendant, was not enough. It required them to comply with the specific requirements, the specific description of that notice in the statute. I break that notice down into two parts, the first being the content of the notice and the second being the method of the notice. So, looking at the content of the notice first, the statute requires that the return of the advance will be requested, and that it be requested to be done within 15 days of receipt. That content, in this case, was never established by the Commonwealth. There was testimony given by the witness in the case, Mr. Grantham, as it related to the content. He testified that it was a form letter that was sent, that the form letter was actually drafted by his wife. He believed, upon some questioning, that he had read the letter, but that he couldn't state to the court anything about what it contained, any specifics of the language, simply that it was a form letter that his wife had drafted that he believed at some point he had read prior to being the person who mailed it. Commonwealth presented no additional evidence as it related to the content of that particular letter. There were actually two letters sent in this particular case. I'm not sure for the purposes of content that it matters which letter we're discussing. There was no testimony that the letters were identical. However, because of the complete lack of testimony as it relates to the content at all, I think the same argument would apply regardless of which of the letters the court were examining.
But neither letter is in the record. Is that right?
Well, there is a sealed and never opened at trial letter, I believe, is in the record now.
The first one
that came back returned to sender. The second letter was apparently received at some point and signed for. That letter is not in the record.
Why didn't the trial court open it to find out if the letters are basically the same forms, to infer from the first what the second said?
I don't know why the trial court chose not to open the letter. There was a suggestion, I believe, by the prosecutor in the case that actually was an option. For my understanding from the record is that the court didn't believe it was necessary at that point to examine the issue any further, that it was satisfied with what had been presented, which of course I take issue with this morning, but I believe that's probably why the letter was not opened at trial.
Wasn't the first letter introduced for a limited purpose? The judge only accepted it for the purpose of showing what address it was sent to?
I think upon objection and then the judge's ruling, I think she did admit it for a somewhat limited purpose. I'm not sure that would have prevented her from still opening the letter, but I think that is why it was eventually admitted into evidence.
But it's a crucial point, isn't it? If the prosecution didn't ask for it to be reviewed on the the substance of the letter, and there was apparently a limited review given by the trial court for purposes of the last known address, then I guess your argument would be that's not before the trial court, the contents of the letter, and thus it's not before us.
That's correct. That would be my position this morning. I would even go a step further to suggest that if we were to have an interest this morning in opening that letter, it would suggest that the specific content, the specific language, was in fact necessary to be determined. I would argue that certainly the Commonwealth must establish what the content of that letter is, and so I think merely by having the conversation about whether or not the letter should have been opened, there is a demonstration that the content included in that letter, and what it may say about the content that may have been included in the second letter, would be important and would be necessary for the Commonwealth to make a showing of. As it was in front of the court, there was no specific evidence presented as to what was included in the letter. A form letter can, of course, take many different meanings. There are many kinds of form letters, as it might relate to construction contracts. Certainly the parties in this case could have chosen to pursue this civilly, and there may have been a number of form letters that would have been available to them under those circumstances. So to suggest that the terminology of a form letter give us any indication of what this letter contained, I think, is somewhat misleading. Also, specifically, there is the only evidence as it related to what might have been in the letter comes later in the discussion of the conversations had between Mr. Bowman and Mr. Grantham after Mr. Grantham presumed that the second letter had been received. And it's at that time that there's a conversation about Mr. Bowman potentially returning the liner, the pool liner, to Mr. Grantham at that time. I think that even further suggests that the content of the letter was not necessarily a request to return the advance, but perhaps some desire for continued performance of the contract or an alternative in way to resolve the issue by potentially delivering part of the product.
So the letter could have said, either give me the money back or put the liner in, one of the two.
I think it could have. I think it's also entirely conceivable that the letter said some reference to an immediate performance on the contract, or
a letter could have said, give me my money, and the guy calls up and says, I don't have your money, but I can bring you a pool line.
I think that could have happened. It's certainly possible, but I don't think that we have that information and evidence to make the determination that is what it said. I think we could hypothesize a lot of different things that the letter could have contained and how that conversation would have then led to what occurred, but I'm not sure that we can make a determination based on those facts as to what the actual letter contained.
We can speculate about the contents of the letter, but didn't the Commonwealth have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt that the letter, in fact, contained a request for the return of the money?
Absolutely. I would reference again the court's holding in Jimenez that this is a material element, the notice requirement, and specifically the plain language of the statute does require that be what the letter demand. And so I would say yes, the Commonwealth would be required to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't even think that burden is necessarily very high. All the Commonwealth had to do in this case was bring in anyone who had some vague idea of what was included in this letter, but that wasn't done.
Bowman testified in trial, correct?
He did.
Were you his trial counsel?
I was.
They could have asked him on cross-examination, what did the letter say? Because he signed the letter, right?
Correct. They could have asked him a number of questions. I don't believe there was any cross-examination by the Commonwealth.
They could have laid the foundation for the envelope to be opened. Did they not? Or perhaps did lay the foundation for the envelope to be opened?
I think they certainly could have pursued that with Mr. Bowman, yes.
Might the Commonwealth have known what the letter said? And therefore it wasn't opened.
I certainly can't speak to that, Your Honor. I'm not sure. I think, frankly, I have no idea what the contents of that letter were. I think that the court doesn't need to go further than that this morning on this issue, because I think that the content is, and the fact that it was not established by the Commonwealth is certainly dispositive in this case. However, I think there also is a secondary issue with, first, as I mentioned, the two parts of the notice requirement, the first being the content and the second being the method. I also don't think that the Commonwealth met their burden of establishing that the method required by the statute of providing this notice was followed. Again, there's a circumstance where, as it relates to the addresses in this case, there's just a complete lack of knowledge by the witness as to where this information came from. There's testimony as it relates to two addresses, one on the first letter, one on the second. On cross-examination, Mr. Grantham testified that he got the first address from the bottom of the receipt, which, of course, the physical evidence as presented to the trial court can establish is not the case. There was an address written on the bottom of the receipt, but it was not the one for which the letter was eventually sent. And the second address on the second letter, which was eventually received by someone at some point, was a P.O. box, the source of which, again, Mr. Grantham had no idea and was not able to inform the court.
Well, when you said it was received by someone at some point, I thought it had been, in fact, signed for by Mr. Bowman. It was certified mail, return receipt requested, and he signed the receipt.
Well, I think there's a signature of a Mr. Bowman on the receipt. I don't believe that Mr. Bowman's testimony included any verification of whether or not that was him, or at what point he received that, and what information he had at that time. So the only reason I qualify that statement. I think that in that, under those circumstances, again, very specifically, I'm construing this requirement, but I think that is the plain language of the statute, that those are the two ways by which the individual should gain the address. I certainly think there is a situation where the court could presume that some of this is overly restrictive. I think the Commonwealth might have cured that issue by putting on some evidence from their witness of the efforts that were made to gain a correct address, and then the fact that they did essentially the best that they could. But that evidence was not placed into evidence in trial. There was no testimony as related to that. It was simply the indication that he didn't know where the addresses had come from at all. And I think in a criminal case, with someone's liberty at risk, I think that to meet one of the material elements, the burden is certainly higher than that. I'll run into my rebuttal time here for a moment.
You have 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
I apologize.
You want to save your time? 2 minutes and 40 seconds. Sorry.
May it please the court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. And I think there are arguments to be made. I know this is a difficult case, and obviously I heard the court's questions as my opponent argued. I think that there are arguments to be made in this case as to why the Court of Appeals was not incorrect in affirming this judgment, and why the trial judge found that the Commonwealth had met its burden. And first of all, as this court is very, very well aware, of course, this is a claim that the evidence was insufficient, and the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and that includes the reasonable inferences from that evidence. And so the backdrop of the claims that come before this court is that Mr. Grantham paid $2,100 to Mr. Bowman. Mr. Bowman failed to do the work. He used the money to keep his business rolling, and he lied to Mr. Grantham that he had actually purchased the liner, or at least he told the detective later that he did not. And so with this backdrop, the two issues come before the court, the content of the letter and the address. And I will say, first of all, that the address, I think, is a much easier issue. It's the most easier issue for me.
Can I ask you this on the content of the letter? The liner was a big deal to the owner, right?
Yes, it was.
And so it appears from his testimony after the second letter went out that he was still apparently negotiating to get the liner, if there was a liner. He was assuming there was a liner. Doesn't that lead to the inference that whatever the letter said, it didn't say, walk away, give me the money, I want nothing to do with you. It could have quite reasonably have said, look, I'm really unhappy with you, and maybe this is over, but I at least want part of this done. I want the liner. Now, if it said the latter, of course, that would be inadequate under the statute.
I was going to agree with the first part of what you said. I think that I disagree with the last part of what you said with regard to it being inadequate under the statute. And that is that the statute, first of all, refers to a request. And it refers to a request for return of such advance. And the advance in this case was money, but that money was to be used to buy the liner. And the statute actually contemplates if there's an advance of something else, some other merchandise, that that could be the subject of the letter. And I think that even though this is a penal statute, it is too narrow to read that if you don't ask specifically for the money alone, as opposed to some merchandise or other item, which could have occurred in this case,
so
that's
you're reading
a failure.
Advance to be something other than the cash advance?
Yes. That the advance, the statute contemplates that there could be other than money. Failed to substantially make good such advance, deemed guilty of larceny of such money, merchandise, or other thing.
But the notice provision says fails to return such advance after 15 days of a request to do so. So the to do so is return such advance.
Correct. And, okay. And in this case, the money that was advanced was to purchase the liner, and the liner then is the merchandise. I want to say that I think that what's
so returning the liner is returning the advance?
If the advance was to be used to purchase the liner, which was the purpose in this case, then a demand for the liner would be a request for the return, and it would be sufficient.
I think you may be reading that too generously, Ms. Tyson. It says he shall be deemed guilty of larceny of such money, merchandise, or other thing. He shall be guilty of those things if he fails to return the advance. And so the code is specifically focusing on the failure to return the advance.
Yes.
You shall be guilty of the larceny of the
yes.
liner.
Yes.
Not you can return the liner in lieu of the advance.
I think that one of the... And I don't want to not answer the questions, but before I move to continue, I think that one of the things that is most important to my case, and I argued it in the brief, is an opinion, and it is an opinion of the Court of Appeals, which I acknowledge is not binding on this court. This court did refuse the appeal when it came to this court after it was finished in the Court of Appeals. But the language of the McCary case that we quoted in our brief was that on its face, the statute does not impose substantive requirements on the request to do so. In other words, the statute doesn't set forth exactly what must be in the demand letter. And I disagree that the letter has to ask for the return within 15 days. I think that the legislature has deemed that 15 days is reasonable for someone to respond to that. And then,
I agree with you on that. I think a lot of people misinterpret that statute that it has to be return the money within 15 days. It's return the money, and then if it's not done so within 15 days, then the person can be charged with
correct,
larceny.
Correct, is deemed guilty of the larceny. The Court of Appeals in the McCary case went on to say the plain language of the statute reveals the legislature intended only that the builder or contractor be put on notice of the claim, affording him an opportunity to return the money or otherwise respond to the claim. And what I think is important in this case is the Court of Appeals placed great weight, I think, on the fact that this form letter that was prepared at the suggestion of law enforcement, and that the police had recommended that it be sent. There's a reasonable inference that the police would not be recommending that a form letter not in compliance with the statute be sent.
So if the letter had said... I'm requesting that you return the advance I gave you or otherwise respond to my claim. That would be sufficient.
I think that under the holding in McCary, I think that that would be sufficient. But we have more than that. We have more than just a letter that is sent and no definitive proof of what is in the letter. Because I think that the fact that there was an oral conversation after Mr. Bowman had received the letter, and yes, it was admitted at trial. I'm looking at page 47, which is part of the motion to strike, where there was an admission he received the letter. There was a conversation afterwards. I understand that Jimenez stands for the proposition that if you don't send the written notice by certified mail, it does not matter if you had an oral conversation discussing the demand. It doesn't matter if you go to the builder's place of business, he comes to you. Without that written mailing, it's a non-offense. I don't think Jimenez stands for the proposition that an oral conversation or confrontation is irrelevant. And what happened is after the receipt of the letter, there was a telephone conversation in which Mr. Grantham asked Mr. Bowman, you haven't done your work. You haven't done what you told me. Just why don't you just give me the liner, and I'll have someone else put it in. So there was an oral demand. There was notice that you haven't complied with what you've asked me to do.
If, in fact, he was repeating exactly what was in the letter, give me the liner, I'll get somebody else to do it, does that comply with the statutory requirement?
I think that it does when you have both the written notice and the conversation. I think that when the Court of Appeals is looking at this, again, there was no discussion in the Court of Appeals order about the oral conversation. Instead, they looked at the fact that it was a form letter for this purpose that law enforcement had recommended, and that the reasonable inference is that it was in compliance with the statute. And again, I understand this is a penal statute, but to narrowly confine what must happen, particularly when this court held in Hallsapple that actually the contractor doesn't even have to receive it. If the demand is sent and it's sent certified mail, return receipt requested, it's not even necessary that the contractor actually receive that notice. Here we have receipt of the notice and a follow-up conversation that put him more than on notice that he had not complied with the terms of the contract, and asking that that the homeowner be made whole, and be made whole by, well, why don't you just give me the liner and I'll get somebody else to put it in. Of course, the response
but
from
again,
Mr. Bowman,
that ends up, it sounds more like a negotiation, an ongoing negotiation about what he was willing to accept at that point. That's the problem with the conversation.
I understand, Your Honor, and I guess that in light of McCary, and perhaps I'm putting too many of my eggs in this McCary basket, but that given this published case that is there, and again, from the Court of Appeals, that actually what happened in this Bowman case would be in accordance with what was in the McCary opinion with regard to construction fraud.
And is your argument that it would satisfy both the content of the letter and the propriety of the notice? The conversation would cover both of those issues?
I think that it supplements, if I'm understanding your question, Your Honor, I think it supplements the fact that it was a form letter recommended by the police, that there was this additional confrontation, this additional conversation between the parties, so that the contractor knew a demand was made of him and he could respond to that claim, which is what he did by saying, I can't do that, and then offering the police to return the money, but he didn't, and so on as the case evolved.
Seems to me there are any number of points in this trial where the contents of the letter could have been determined. Could have opened the first letter, laid the foundation that the first letter was the same as the second letter. It had just been sent to a different address. You could have asked the police officer. Police officer testified. I'm not sure he was the one that gave the form letter, but you know, what does the form letter say that the police give out to people in these situations complaining of construction fraud?
Right.
And they could have asked Bowman on cross-examination. You got the letter. What did it say?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there are a number of places, and I was looking feverishly earlier. I thought there was an objection to the judge opening that letter by the defense. I was not able to find it, so it may not exist. I do see that on page 28 it appears of the appendix that the defense was telling the court that it was really only the second letter that was relevant. The court said, I'm going to consider everything, and it's absolutely clear from looking at the record that envelope was not open. I will state, and I understand it is the Commonwealth's burden, but I will state that Mr. Bowman is perhaps the only person in the courtroom who knew what that letter said because he had received it. He chose, of course, to testify, which he did not have to do. And certainly, of all the things that he testified to, he didn't say anything about what was in the letter or what was not in the letter.
Because he wasn't asked by the Commonwealth.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
He was not asked by the Commonwealth.
No, Your Honor, it was not. He was not asked by the Commonwealth. And I think that, obviously, the difficulty of not of Mr. Grantham not saving a copy so he could bring it in, not recalling what was in the letter is a difficulty. I don't think that it is a fatal difficulty in light of the prior case law and in light of what we have as far as the circumstantial evidence in the case, with the fact that the certified mailing was made, it was made a second time when the first was unsuccessful, and then there was the conversation. If the court is troubled at all by the address, I think the fact that the defendant received the second letter takes care of that issue. Otherwise, you could have someone who is a contractor who is the most defrauding contractor in the world and simply not give you an address and not give you a contract, and you would never be able to enforce your rights under this statute. And so with all of the evidence that's before the court, including the oral conversation and the other bits of circumstantial evidence, we would urge the court to find that the Court of Appeals did not err in affirming the trial court in this case. And if there are no other questions, that is our position in this matter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
2 minutes and 40 seconds.
Just take up two brief follow-ups to Attorney General's argument. First, I think it's a little bit hasty to suggest that whoever the patrol officer was that responded when they phoned the police and recommended that they send a form letter would have been able to effectively communicate what needed to be in that letter, considering the discussion we're having today about the potential confusion over what is required or isn't required to be in that letter after a great deal of research and addressing the case law here. I think it's perhaps too much credit to give the officer that he was able to do that effectively, and that form letter would then have, of course, met all the requirements. I also think it's very important that the two cases that were cited in both briefs, the two cases that were just discussed by counsel, Jimenez says that an oral conversation where actual notice is received by the contractor is not enough to comply with the statute. Then the court says in Holsapple that sending a letter and then there being absolutely no receipt, no notice actually provided to the contractor is also in keeping with the requirements of the statute. I think the only way to square those two cases with each other is that the specific requirements laid out in the statute for the content and the method by which the notice should be provided are the requirement. It's not that the notice actually make it there and that the person get the information, because the court has said that the verbal conversation where there was actual notice is not enough to meet the requirements. And it's not that that just the letter make it to the person, because it doesn't have to make it to the person at all, as Holsapple suggested. I think squaring those two cases together is supportive of the position that the requirements laid out are the material element in the case and that they must be followed specifically by the Commonwealth, and that must be established in order to find someone guilty of obstruction fraud.
Could you address McCary also?
I will. I think McCary is a difficult case because it's such a general assessment of the issues that we're talking about here. I think that to suggest that it's not that there's no substantive requirement laid out in this statute as to what needs to actually be done is then undercut by those two cases I just mentioned, that there is a requirement that the method be followed, that the specific content be included, and it's not just good enough that it got there, that the notice was received. That's been clearly held not to be good enough, and as such, I don't think that McCary can hold up to those two standards.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Call the next case.